There can be bad language and adult concepts in this program. So please watch out for little ears if you've got your podcast playing and pop on some headphones. That way no one can get offended but you.
I thought that was quite clever, that this idea of writing about the past but setting it in the future enables people who are in the present to look at it and understand, imagine what happened to people in the past because they're thinking about the future.
You're listening to the Rights for Women podcast, where we celebrate women writers, support women's rights, and talk all things women and writing. I'm Kel Butler, podcaster and wannabe author. I'm founder of Listen Up Podcasting, where we make podcasts for a positive world. Check me out at www.listenuppodcasting.com.au or find me on Facebook.
And I'm Pamela Cook, author of 5 novels, 4 traditionally published and 1 indie release. I'm a writing teacher and a podcaster. My latest release, Cross My Heart, is available now at all online retailers and at pamelacook.com.au.
Listen to all of our episodes at www.rightsforwomen.com or subscribe wherever you get your pods. Today on the Convo Couch, I am chatting with acclaimed author Claire G. Coleman. Claire describes herself as a Noongar woman whose family have belonged to the south coast of Western Australia since long before history started being recorded. She writes fiction, essays, and poetry, while mostly travelling around the continent now called Australia in a ragged caravan towed by an ancient troopy. You'll find that on her own website. Claire is the author of Terra Nullius and The Old Lie, both speculative fiction novels steeped in a devastating personal history. Terra Nullius poured out of Claire in 3 months while travelling around Australia. The manuscript won the Black and Right Fellowship and was nominated for the Stella Prize and the Aurealis Award. Today, Claire talks about the creative momentum that led to that first book and writing speculative fiction from a First Nations perspective. Thank you for joining me on the Convo Couch today, Claire.
No problem. Thank you.
I just wanted to start today with, you have said in a previous interview, it was about a year or so ago, that an apocalypse is a collapse of a system. And the collapse of the economy is something that you felt was inevitable at some point and could be incredibly apocalyptic. Given the state of where we're sitting today, where we've just gone through these horrific bushfires and climate change is irreversibly changing the structure of our world and what our future is going to look like, and also now isolated by a virus, an invisible sort of warrior, so to speak, who's coming in and shifting all of our behaviours, and it's all out of our control. Is this coming true for you?
I think so. The funny thing is that people have always imagined the apocalypse as being like one catastrophic event that wipes everything out at once. But what we've had instead, COVID-19 is a pretty catastrophic sudden event. But really, it's coming on the back, in Australia at least, it's landing on the back of the catastrophic bushfires. So, and then, of course, there is going to be a catastrophic economic collapse. That seems inevitable right now. With all this, the combination of like catastrophe, riding on the back of catastrophe, I think we are having a situation where it seems that an apocalypse is inevitable. And I think the only hope we can take from that is that after an apocalypse, it seems it's possible to recover to a society does recover, and often it ends up better than it was. Let's hope that happens.
Let's go to writing speculative fiction. I'm actually going to start from where I would normally end this interview and ask, has this moment in time, this sort of convergence of your fiction and your reality coming together in your lived experience, is it changing how you're looking at writing now?
It's certainly interesting. It's funny because there's this running joke about truth being stranger than fiction. Well, at the moment, truth is in a way more, not necessarily stranger than fiction, but truth is more vicious than fiction.
Mm.
I don't think anyone could have written a novel or something, or maybe they could have, but it'd be very unusual for someone to write a novel where a virus has forced the entire world to voluntarily lock themselves in their houses and not go outside.
Mm.
There's been fiction written of where that sort of social change happens over generations. I can't remember the name of the story, but Isaac Asimov wrote a story about a society where everyone had teleport doors.
Oh, yes.
And then eventually they didn't have to go outside ever, so they were just kind of teleporting in and out of houses. And then there's a family whose teleport door broke. So I can imagine it's really difficult to write science fiction when, again, we're living through science fiction. So it's quite difficult. But on the other hand, watching the social change kind of gives a perspective on how our idea of how an apocalypse unfolds can be more easily understood. This is the first, I suppose, historically the first time of watching a pandemic apocalypse unfold in real time.
Mm, mm. Well, as you've said, that the First Nations people have experienced multiple apocalypses throughout their life, that it's not one event, that you don't see an apocalypse as a single event the way a lot of people do, as one singular thing that, bam, it's all over. You've described it as a challenge people have to survive through, back to that survival element we were talking about. So you're looking at this, you're in the middle of it now, and so you're, as a writer, you're watching to see how humans come out of it?
I am, and I think what people don't understand about cataclysmic or apocalyptic change is that in a way you can consider society to be one society before it and a different society after it.
Yeah.
And I don't think we're going to get through this COVID-19 isolation the same people as when we went into it. I don't see how we could possibly be the same people on the other side of it. Not just the places that have had and are still having apocalyptic death rates. Like New York I mean, looking at the news this morning about New York, and it's extraordinary how many people are dying and how the government's having to react to that. They've opened mass graves.
Yeah.
There's trucks
being pulled up to the back of hospitals where they're pushing the people who are passing away, refrigerated trucks. Like, it's really intense.
New York will never be the same again. New York is, the reason it's copying it so badly, I think, is because everyone lives in such close proximity. It's one of the highest urban population densities on Earth. And that's probably why they're having such problems. Also, the complete lack of socialized medicine. Paranoia and fear of that giving healthcare to all is like giving into socialism. That's basically killing them faster than anything else ever could. But if you think about New York, will never be the same again. I don't think Australia is ever going to be the same again. I think it's weird because I think Australia was never going to be the same again after the bushfires of summer.
Yeah.
And then we've had another kind of cataclysmic event roll on the back of it. If you think about the bushfires, the response of the government to the bushfires was help out those small towns, go there and buy groceries and stuff, and so the small town, and pay for accommodation, etc. So those towns have a chance to build up the tourism money again.
Mm.
And then a few months later, we're told, do not leave
isolate.
Your homes.
Yep. Well, no, they still haven't released huge swathes of that money for the bushfire relief fund, and they haven't really actioned anything, and we're going to go into another bushfire season. And COVID-19 has been a very convenient way in some ways, I think, for them to completely just push the climate change conversation to the side. But COVID-19 will be vaccinated against at some point. It will go. We will get control of it. And we still have to come out and you know, really grapple with who we are in the face of climate change and what our behaviours are there.
And there's a couple of concerns about COVID-19 and the vaccine as well. That, yeah, they're working on vaccines, and they reckon, away or something?
Yeah, about 12 months, yeah.
Coronaviruses as a group of viruses are particularly hard to vaccinate against because they mutate fast.
Mm.
And people aren't thinking about that. The common cold has no vaccine because it's a really fast mutating virus. And by the time they've produced a vaccine for it, it's mutated. Well, the common cold's a coronavirus.
Yeah.
It's a particularly mild one. So I suppose one of the concerns is, to me, what if they never can vaccinate against it?
Well, then I guess that's when they're waiting for us to get to 60% herd immunity. Isn't that sort of where it goes then? We have to try and allow our community to gradually get sick without it overwhelming the hospital system. And
which is...
That's... And then we have to face the fact that we could face this anytime. I'm just interested for you, from your perspective, what are your fears and your hopes with what's happening in society for First Nations Australians?
My fears are that, well, firstly, Aboriginal people have historically had much worse health outcomes than the rest of the community.
Mm.
That's concerning. And also, First Nations Australians are, of all segments of the Australian community, the most reliant on arts and culture as a way to raise money, as work. And the arts has possibly been the industry that's been hit hardest by this. Maybe tourism is slightly harder, but arts following closely upon it. And those are the fears. But the hopes are that perhaps we can use First Nations knowledge systems on surviving cataclysms or surviving the apocalypse to position ourselves as educators within society, not as people who are suffering worse than everybody else. Maybe we can, the rest of Australia will realise that what we're good at is surviving. I haven't seen videos on Instagram by white Australians telling people to wash their bloody hands, but I've seen them in several different Indigenous languages done by artists and musicians and people like that, just doing it on their own Instagram accounts in Indigenous languages, demonstrating to the kids how to wash their hands properly so their fans will do it right.
Well, this individualistic thinking from my understanding is just not a part of First Nations community. Is that right?
That is true. The First Nations communities, First Nations culture is built more on first and foremost on notions of connection and respect, on where you fit within society and showing respect to people you should respect and being respected by people who should respect you. But most importantly, it's in this idea that it's not who you are that's important as in an individual. It's who you're connected to so that your connections can be used to make society stronger. So from that point of view, Indigenous people have this kind of collective idea that will be helpful because we need to head towards more collectivism now anyway, and Indigenous Australians have always been good at it. On the other hand, that collectivism is a risk because there's a situation with people wanting to return to community, and if someone gets sick before they return to community, they can take the disease back to community. And that's concerning, which is why I suppose when it first hit the Northern Territory, I don't know if you heard of this, but when COVID-19 first hit the Northern Territory, the local Aboriginal town councils, every town in the Northern Territory has an Aboriginal kind of cultural council who look after the Indigenous needs in that area. Mm. Those Indigenous councils set up services to take anybody who wanted to go home to community, take them home before the disease hit the area.
Oh, no, I didn't hear of that. That's
so they were
fantastic.
Transporting people in, they were basically giving people money or assistance to get them home before they got sick.
That's how you survive, once again. You bring everyone together and you work as a community, as a team, and it's ensuring people's safety and survival, which is not something that I see a lot in my own colonial background. I'd like to go back to Terra Nullius, if that's okay now. So both of your books are inspired by your discovery of your history and by your grandfather. And Terra Nullius, which is an incredible book, and I'm not going to say a lot about it, but it will make your brain spin when you read it. You think you're somewhere and then you're not, and you're somewhere completely different. And that's all I'm going to say. That book, with so many complexities, it took you 9 months in a caravan to write, and you say it poured out of you like an idea was looking for you as a vehicle. Yes. And you were just the vessel for this story. Start there and just tell us about that.
Sure. Well, it was actually, it's been pointed out to me by my partner that it probably wasn't actually 9 months. It's probably less.
Oh.
Well, almost certainly less than 9 months, more like 4 months to get the first draft out. And she just shouted from the other room that it was 3 months to get the first draft out. I'm not sure.
3 months?
It was.
What?
I went to my ancestral country and visited the town where my grandfather was born. And we didn't know much about my family history at this point, but we found it in a little museum in what was originally the town dance hall, because, you know, towns don't have dance halls anymore. We found an entire wall of photos of my extended family, photos that I'd never seen and my dad had never seen. And so we got talking to the people there, and they encouraged us to return to see the opening of a memorial to the massacre that happened just out of town. And when I was there, I heard the full story of the massacre for the first time. I knew there'd been a massacre in that area. I didn't know how big the massacre was. I just knew there was a massacre. And I think that day at the massacre memorial opening, when I met members of my Noongar family I'd never met before, and I heard the story of the massacre in detail for the first time ever. And it was then that I realized that not only was there a massacre in the town where my grandfather was born, but my grandfather's grandmother's extended family would have been involved, as it would have been killed. Yeah, so the idea that was to become Terra Nullius just popped into my head like it had been waiting in the wings, and I couldn't stop writing it. I just wrote. I wrote in this incredible fever to get this story finished.
And you hadn't written before?
I'd written some poetry, but no, I hadn't written anything. I'd never been published before.
And this just came to you in this moment, and you went back and you just started, was it with a computer or was it with pen to paper? How did it flow from you?
I had a computer, but I had nowhere to charge it in my caravan because I was in a caravan traveling. But I had an iPad that had a car charger. So I wrote it on an iPad with a little Bluetooth keyboard, a secondhand iPad 2 to be exact.
And because this is multi-dimensional storytelling, and not necessarily, I don't want people to get the wrong idea, I'm not talking about space at this, as in different dimensions in space, but multi-dimensional as in the storytelling itself. And you've never written before, and this is pouring out of you. So it's hard to talk about without giving things away, isn't it?
It is. What it comes down to, I think, is the story, all the layers and complexity in the story were already there before I started writing.
How did that come together in your head and your writing? Like, did it all just do it? Did you write it in sequence, or was it bits and pieces, or how did you bring all those layers together?
Mostly, it was in sequence. The first draft of the I suppose you call it the middle, the most important scene, the first draft of that, which is, as you know, it's somewhere in the middle. We won't say what the scene is, but the first draft of that was written first, and the first draft of the last scene was written soon after, straight after that, pretty much.
Really?
Oh. But the rest of it was written in sequence. It's funny that the very last scene, pretty much, was one of the first things I wrote, and it is the least altered scene of the entire book, virtually unedited, because it just I think I nailed that scene pretty much straight away, and that one's one of the ones that said the least edits.
So that just came to you complete.
Yeah, the very last thing came to me in a certain place. I was at a place. I looked around, and the kind of, in a way, sometimes with Terra Nullius, scenes and the places I was in at the time kind of fed each other. The scene existed.
Yes, because of where you were when you got inspired in the first place as well.
And that very last scene, I was standing in next to my car in a certain spot, and I jumped back into my... I jumped into my caravan and grabbed my iPad and typed up that scene on the side of the road.
The characters, did they come the same way? Did they just come as they were, or did you have to get to know them?
Some of the characters, I had to get to know all of them. As Jackie, he didn't really need to change much. Some of them just had to be there like they were. But a couple of them didn't. I suppose I do a thing when I'm writing called backfilling, which is when you go, it's like you're leveling some ground. You look back and you go, oh, that bit's got a hole in it. Chuck some dirt. A couple of the characters, I needed them later in the book, and so I added them, and then I had to go back in and insert them earlier so they so it makes sense. besides that, it was a sequence.
So was that in the editing process? Or was that when you'd written it and then went, oops, hang on a minute, and this is the backfilling part as you're writing?
Yeah, I backfilled as I wrote, yeah. Yeah, and but also fixed, smooth things out in the edit. So I did a ridiculous amount of editing, like an obscene amount of editing. I firmly believe that that the first draft is the art of writing, but the craft is the edit.
Yeah.
You spend more time and you need more craft skills during the edit than you do during the first draft.
But you sent the first draft out as the manuscript for your application for the Black and Right Fellowship, is that correct?
It depends. It's funny, the words first draft, they're funny words, because to a writer, the first draft is the very first time their story is finished and complete. And they do a couple more edits before sending it to a publisher. When a publisher gets it, they call that the first draft. So I'd edited it three or four times before I sent it to Black and White, on my own though, without anyone else looking at it. And then after one that, it went through more edits than I can actually remember. Lots of edits. Say a lot. It was a first draft by the way the publishers, my publisher looked at it when I sent it to Black and White, but I'd been working on it. I'd rewritten it a couple of times by that stage.
So when you sort of had this inspiration and then the flurry of writing for 3 months and then you've got this book, how did that feel? Like, did you sit there and go, oh, my God, I've just written a book?
Basically, yeah. And, of course, at that stage I had no idea. I'm trying to get a way to say this. At this that stage, I had no idea whether or not I was a good writer.
Well, you had no yardstick, really, did you?
No, I'd never written a book before. I'd never published anything before. So I hadn't even published poetries or essays in journals.
Did you want to write a book? Is this something that had been a dream of yours?
It was, and I had a 20,000 word manuscript already on my laptop when I came up with the idea for Terra Nullius. And I don't think I've got that in that manuscript anymore, because I don't even have that laptop anymore, so it's probably gone. I don't regret having abandoned my other manuscript, but I had a manuscript I wanted to write while I was traveling, but I didn't expect it to happen like that.
Had you decided that you were going to go for you're going to write a book and try to become a published writer on this trip?
Well, I wanted to try and write on the trip. I I wanted to be a writer all my life. It's one of those things you go, I want to be a writer, and everyone goes, don't be silly, no one makes it as a writer. And they're right, no one makes it as a writer. It was one of those things that I wanted to do in my life that I never imagined I'd actually be able to achieve. I didn't think I was going to actually write a book on the world traveling. I thought I'd like to, but I didn't think I would actually would do it. If that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it makes complete sense. And was it always going to be speculative fiction? Because I know that you love to read sci-fi and spec fiction. Mm-hmm. So was it always going to be that was the genre you were going to write in, or was that also kind of just a surprise that came out of you?
Well, the novel I was writing before that was science fiction. I can't remember the plot. I just remember it was science fiction. Mm. I was always going to write speculative or science fiction. Mm. What I didn't expect is that that Terra Nullius would be considered to be literary speculative fiction, or be kind of in that fertile ground between sci-fi and literature. I didn't expect that because I didn't know enough about the publishing industry to know that generally it's considered a bad idea to write science fiction in Australia. I did not know that.
But it's got a really loyal readership. Hugely loyal.
Science fiction sells like mad worldwide. The reason they say not to write science fiction in Australia is because Australian publishers don't even try particularly hard to compete with American science fiction. But I don't think publishers mention often that the reason not much science fiction gets published in Australia is because it doesn't get picked up. Also, Australian publishing, let's face it, a lot of our publishers are reliant on the notion of trying to get a book picked up for the international market.
Yeah.
Because the Australian market isn't that huge. And again, Australian science fiction doesn't get into other countries quite particularly well.
Well, I think one of the extraordinary things about the way you use science fiction and speculative fiction is the way that you use it as a reflection of history. And I know that that gets done quite a bit, but I think you use it in a way that allows truth to come through and be digested without it instantly dividing people. It allows people to be able to step away from their own bias, I think I'm trying to say, and see our history from an outside perspective. Is that what you're trying to achieve?
Well, when I started writing Terra Nullius, the idea was to write a novel that would help outsiders to Indigenous history understand how it felt to be colonised. That was my aim. I just couldn't make it until the point where the story of Terra Nullius came to me. I couldn't work out a way to do it.
So that's what was brewing within you.
Yeah.
It was that you wanted somehow a vehicle.
Yes. I got irritated at people saying, oh, colonisation was so long ago, or colonisation was peaceful, or you're all better off now that after the English came. Those three statements are all lies. So I wanted people to understand how much those statements are lies and understand that it's not acceptable to continue for this country to continue to think that way.
Mm.
In South Africa, after apartheid, they had the concept of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission because the government decided that they can't correct the damage done by their past unless they accept what their past is. Australia is not ready to look into the past and say, this is what happened, this is what we did, and work out a way to fix it. Australia still is in denial about what this country's history was.
Yeah. And I think the rejection of the Uluru Statement of the Heart is a classic example of that.
And the intent to take a replica Captain replica Endeavour on a circumnavigation of Australia, the intent to do that when the Endeavour never circumnavigated Australia. So it's not a reenactment. As Aboriginal people joke all the time, it's not a reenactment of Cook's voyage, it's an enactment.
Yeah.
It's a fantasy. We're the only country that does it. Every other country on Earth has something else to celebrate as a national day. We're the only historically colonial nation that has the day of invasion as the national day. I said that once on social media. Someone from America said, we celebrate Columbus Day. It's like, yeah, sure you do. But that's not their national day. Independence Day.
Very true. Well, let's take this and talk about then the First Nations influence on speculative fiction and sci-fi, because you've spoken about how colonial science fiction is, just in its essence, how its whole approach is highly colonial. It's always about invasion and colonizing another planet and, you know, finding something livable and assuming that it doesn't already have a species or a culture living there, and that's just reflective completely of our culture and our planet here on Earth. So First Nations writers would come at that with a completely different perspective. So, yeah, talk to us about that and what that means for the genre.
Well, I think the genre, not only has it traditionally been colonial, it's also been quite racist. An example I use is Star Wars. And Star Wars is not, when I talk about racism in Star Wars, I'm kind of making the what's considered to be a dubious move of conflating alien species with race, which is often overdone in analyses of science fiction. But in Star Wars, if you think about it, there's only one of the hero characters, ones who are important to the story, who the story follows, there's only one non-human, and it's a non-speaking role. It's Chewbacca.
Mm.
So yeah. If you think about it that way, and in Star Trek, the original Star Trek, there's only one non-human. He's a Vulcan who's just basically a human with pointy ears.
Mm.
So when you think about it that way, science fiction has always had a race problem and it's had a gender problem. Now, what First Nations people are starting to do is we're kind of refusing to accept the way that this is looked at and thinking, well, why can't we write science fiction that's more interested in the people who are colonized rather than the colonizers? Why can't we talk about, like, well, one thing that particularly interests me is talking about the little people who are ignored by the story, if that makes sense. What I mention often is in Star Wars, there's this idea that the Jedi are supposed to be this holy order who are peaceful and better than everyone else and great people. But Obi-Wan Kenobi in a bar chopped someone's arm off just for harassing him in a bar.
Mm, yeah.
And I don't think about Obi-Wan Kenobi's story. I often think what happened to that poor Grady's arm chopped off.
and it's not where people usually go, is it?
No, they don't think, what about that poor guy? Sure, okay, he was a bully and a bit of a bastard, but surely Obi-Wan Kenobi, who has just managed to mind control some stormtroopers, could mind control a guy into putting his gun down. Instead, he chopped his arm off. Or could have chopped the gun. That's what I say all the time. He could have chopped the gun in half, which is, he didn't have to, if he's that good with his lightsaber, he didn't have to chop his arm off. So I think about things like that, and I think about the classic one people pointed out, which is apparently Captain Kirk was based vaguely on Captain Cook. Well, if only Captain Cook followed the prime directive from Star Trek the prime directive is don't interfere with cultures more primitive than yours. If only Captain Cook had followed that rule. So I think what I'm rambling towards is the notion that not only could Indigenous people reframe science fiction, but I think for our society to grow up, all of our stories need to be reframed by the victims rather than the victors. Because what humans are more than anything else is we are storied creatures. We tell stories to each other and to ourselves, and our stories define who we are to ourselves and to others. Therefore, the way to change the way people think is to change their narrative. And the way, and I think not only is it possible for First Nations writers to do that, but I think it's imperative. And science fiction, the reason I write science fiction, I call it the Star Wars theorem, which is the majority, the average age of humans right now is younger than, or the average age of Australians is younger than Star Wars.
Oh, so really?
Everyone, Star Wars, yes. Star Wars is 40, Star Wars is like 45 or something, 46 years old, and the average age of Australians is 37.
That just makes you feel old, doesn't it?
So you think about it that way. Our campfire legends is science fiction movies.
Yes, of course. Yeah, it's all just understanding, trying to understand the world, I think, through the process of story.
And the stories we use aren't things like War and Peace or the classic novels of our great grandparents' generation. The stories we use to define our world are Star Wars and Star Trek and the Frankenstein movies.
Mm. Well, you have said that speculative fiction is one of the most powerful political tools that we have in fiction at the moment.
It is. The thing about speculative fiction and what makes it so powerful is the ability to weave the world around your concept.
Oh, yes.
You come up with a story and weave your world around it. And therefore, you can create an entire world where the world itself is didactic.
Yes, and you can spin everything around because there are no rules.
If you think about, for example, The Handmaid's Tale, it's not the story of The Handmaid's Tale that teaches us a lesson. It's actually the world building. And the story is just to unfold the world.
Oh, my goodness, I never considered that world building. You're so right. And even Charlotte Wood's Natural Way of Things is a similar thing. She's created a world there.
That's the other thing people always talk about science fiction, speculative fiction and fantasy authors being focusing on world building. Well, everybody does world building.
Yeah.
Anyone who writes a story does world building, you have to do world building because you have to, even if your world building is building the relationships of the people in your story, that's still world building.
It really is. I'd never thought of it that way. I love that. That was like one of those mind-blown moments there. Thank you. So in building your world, the world in Terra Nullius, did that come easily and naturally? Did you see them? Where did the landscapes come from? Obviously history, but.
The thing about my world building is most people would be shocked to hear this, but I never actually consciously or comprehensively world build.
Really?
The world of both Terra Nullius and The Old Lie, just the world, the story world that is in my head, not something I've sat down and written details about. It's like the world is only there. It's somewhere for the characters to exist in, but it's kind of in my imagination. And I don't know how, sometimes I'm not sure how I maintain internal consistency because I never write down a plan for my world building. It just happens.
You just pantser the world as well as the story.
I do. I'm a total pantser. I am the pantserest pantser. But the thing is, if anyone wants advice in writing, best way to get away with being an epic pantser is to be also a really, 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 really comprehensive and obsessive editor. Because if you pant something and it's inconsistent, you can go back and rewrite it.
So you don't make any notes about different characters, different species, different.
If I want to write, if I want to chuck things like that in, what I do is I write a scene that explains it to myself. And then sometimes those scenes don't make the final cut, but at least I've written a scene with a character or a world or environment in it that helps me understand what that place is. And I think it's because we don't just believe that we are people of story. I live that we are people of story. I think that the best way to make sure you understand a world is actually write it.
So you're building it around yourself as you go. Yeah.
I think the experience of writing something is quite painful because The easiest way for me to write a story for a way for, that people feel it well is to feel it myself. And I said before to people that if I write a scene and it's not, I don't feel emotionally blasted at the end of an important scene, it needs to be rewritten because it obviously isn't going to work. Because if it doesn't hurt me, it's not going to hurt anyone else. So there's scenes in Terra Nullius that needed to be extremely traumatic, and it traumatized me to write them.
So when that, what happened, what did you do in those moments? Like, so if you're writing a scene and it's traumatizing you to write it, how do you protect yourself as a writer in those moments?
I don't. I just let it, I just feel it and let myself feel it. But then, often, funny thing is, if I'm writing something traumatic, the trauma goes away really, really quickly after I've finished the experience of writing it. And it's like when you're feeling really ill, I go to bed at night, I get up in the morning and I feel on top of the world. It's almost like I've had a good cry and I feel better now.
A purge. It's like a purge.
It's never easy.
Well, you were saying that you tried to give an impressionistic view of your landscapes because you find that that makes places more unsettling for the reader.
Yes.
Can you explain that a bit?
Sure. There's a couple of parts to that. Firstly, I used landscape like a character, and I used it as a way to give an emotional positioning for the audience. So a landscape that's bleak gives it a bleak kind of emotional reaction. So not only was I trying to give people an idea of how they should feel using landscape, I suppose in the same way that a filmmaker uses soundtrack, but also the way I wrote landscape was used to tell the audience the personality of the characters, how they react to different landscapes. It's in a way reactions to in a lot of time in writing, people write the way you know about characters is how they react to each other. And in that way, I treat a landscape like it's one of the characters, that the way people react to the landscape is the main clue of what sort of person they were. So, and I've done that in, I did that in The Old Lie as well. The idea that landscape is, I suppose, our main way of understanding the world is by looking at the places we're in, and therefore my way of understanding each, other people in my books is by giving people an idea of what someone, how someone's reacting to the landscape. On the other hand, the other reason it's kind of impressionistic is there's no way anyone would be able to track the movements of the characters by where they are in the physical landscapes of the country I was writing about, because I moved everything.
Yes.
It didn't suit my story for the landscapes to actually line up with time. It more suited my story to have landscapes meet up with parts of the story. The look of a landscape might have meet up with part of the story. So there's times when people are in one place, people go, yeah, but they can't have gone from that landscape to the other landscape next to it because they're traveling the wrong direction. Yeah, I know that, but I don't care.
But also what you're sort of speaking of there in terms of landscape and connection and movement and all of that, that from my understanding is also something that's firmly grounded in First Nations culture and thinking. Is that right?
Yeah, it is. And although I mean, historically I did not grow up within an Indigenous community or even knowing I was Indigenous, which is a complicated life experience for anybody. But I think I got my understanding of landscape from my dad, and my dad is very firmly embedded in place. For me personally, the way I when I think of happy times, generally the easiest thing for me to think of is a place where I was when I was that happy. So always, I don't know whether it's my upbringing from my dad, whether it's genetics for being Indigenous, or whether it's just me, but places are extremely important to me personally, and I don't understand I cannot understand the world without understanding where those landscapes are.
So they're your framework.
They're my framework to understand the world. And my other framework is stories. So I suppose landscape and story is all that I care about.
Yeah, and that comes out so strongly in your own books. So it makes complete sense. Moving on, actually, speaking of your books, because I'm just looking at the time here, I would like to have a little chat about The Old Lie, and which is another one that, as I said before, was inspired by your grandfather as well and his story. So do you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, well, the same. It was only a few weeks after I came up with the idea for Terra Nullius, I visited my grandfather's grave, again with my dad, and my grandfather's grave was unmarked. Now, my grandfather was a World War II digger, and as everyone would no doubt know, there's absolutely no chance generally of a World War II digger not having a soldier's gravestone on their grave. My grandfather didn't have one. And then a bit of research later, I found out that no Aboriginal graves in WA had them. And then a bit more research, I found out that Aboriginal soldiers weren't given soldier settlement land or war pension or any of the other benefits of being a soldier. And also that I read in a book that historically and Aboriginal families had the children taken away while their father was at war in World War II, because they were declared, the children were declared to be without a father because the father was at war. And this happened to Aboriginal families in WA as well, to Noongar families. And added all that up, and I came up with the idea for The Old Lie when I put all those things together. So I was writing about the black diggers and how they are mistreated, but I thought it would be easier to tell the story in a way if I put it in space. The reason it's easier to tell the story is I don't like the idea of writing a novel and then someone saying, no, that battle was a different date to what you've put it at.
Actually, yeah, people are a bit like that, aren't they?
They are,
especially
like
nowadays with Google.
And someone once someone interviewed me once, and they said something really interesting, that by putting writing about the past, but writing about it set in the future, it frames the present.
Yeah, and I thought that was quite clever. Yes.
I thought that was quite clever, that this idea of writing about the past but setting it in the future enables people who are in the present to look at it and understand, imagine what happened to people in the past because they're thinking about the future. So it's like, it's complicated.
No, you know what's funny? In my notes, which something I was actually going to bring up and talk to you about, was I put here, using sci-fi and spec fic to shine a light on the past as it affects the present and informs the future, which is pretty much the exact same thing.
And I like the idea of doing that. And because I think if you said it in the, if I wrote about black diggers in the past, Australians who are kind of allergic to the idea of people talking about Aboriginal suffering in the past go, oh, but that was in the past. So I didn't put it in the past. I put it in the future.
And we do have an unhealthy sort of veil of illusion over certain aspects of our diggers and our history, that it's the rose-coloured glasses element, that we're never allowed to touch that story, even if it's wrong.
I know, and it is wrong. When you tell people how black diggers are treated, everyone's horrified. When you tell people something that generally Australians don't know, that the and you might not know this, I don't know if you've really heard the interviews or mentioned it before, Aboriginal soldiers who went away to the Boer War, which some did, they weren't given a choice either. They were servants of officers who were forced to go over during the Boer War to South Africa, were not allowed to return to the country because of the White Australia policy. And some of them have never been found. They integrated into the South African black communities and stayed there because they weren't allowed to come back.
It's just travesty after travesty committed against First Nations people in this country. You just keep learning of another one, don't you? It's just...
So that one was kind of... Historians have been digging into that, and they don't know how many... They do know that soldiers, Aboriginal soldiers, went over, and they know they weren't allowed to come back, but they don't know how many.
Wow.
And that one's that's horrific.
That's a real insult. Holy hell.
And my grandfather fought in World War II, and so did all his brothers and his cousins, and his uncle fought in World War I, his Noongar uncle.
So once again, the old lie sprung up as a context to be able to have that conversation.
Yes, it did. Or I don't think there's I think it's important. It's a useful tool. Let's just put it that way. It's a very useful tool for me to be able to have conversations or start conversations that people don't want to have by putting them into speculative fiction novels.
Why aren't more, well, two First Nations Australians, do you think, writing in this genre, and more women writing in this genre? Or is it that it's, you know, just racism and sexism?
Well, yeah, there is that. And, well, I think more women are doing it now. When Taryn Elliott got shortlisted for the Stella Prize, it was also shortlisted for the Aurealis Best Science Fiction Novel Award. And of the six shortlistees in that award, there was only one man on that year. So it is on the rise, women writing speculative fiction in Australia. You can still count the published female speculative fiction authors on one hand, probably. And I think the idea that Aboriginal people don't write speculative fiction, people are starting to. It's an increase in it. The reason we haven't, and this is, I think this is true of anyone from minority backgrounds in Australia, there's been an expectation, in my opinion, in the Australian publishing industry, that the most important books by, that not only should people of minority backgrounds write own voices books, but in fact we should be encouraged to write that. That people are interested in kind of memoir and literary fiction about the communities in which people live rather than the things that people might want to read, like speculative fiction. It's not usual that people who are not kind of straight white young men, it's unusual for us to write science fiction or speculative fiction, I think. It probably is sexism too.
It makes you a unique role model for so many other young writers out there.
I think so.
How did it feel when you got nominated for the Stella for Taryn Elliott? Because, I mean, as we've talked about here, that was a book that rolled out of you. There was no expectations. And, yeah, how did that feel to sort of get that nomination at sort of top of the industry straight off the bat?
Well, that was pretty surreal. And it was actually a surreal year for the Stella Prize as well. It was so weird. Firstly, I knew I'd written speculative fiction, and until then, speculative fiction had never done well in any of the major literary prizes. And also, I was a debut; I didn't expect to do that well. And think about this: the Stella that year, of the six shortlistees for the Stella Prize, two of us also shortlisted for the Aurealis Best Science Fiction Novel.
Mm.
And that year on the Aurealis Best Science Fiction Novel, there were, of the five novels that got Aurealis Best Science Fiction Novel shortlisting, four were marketed as literary fiction, not speculative fiction.
Really?
Yep. And that year on the Aurealis Awards, two of the Aurealis shortlistees were also shortlisted for the Stella Prize, and they'd never been won ever. And that year also, the winner of the Aurealis Award was the first novel shortlisted for the Aurealis and longlisted for the Miles Franklin. So that year was the year that Australian speculative fiction broke out into the mainstream.
So you were nominated for the Stella Prize, nominated for the Aurealis. And so when you wrote Terra Nullius, that's all happening. So when were you writing The Old Lie? Was that straight after Terra Nullius?
The moment that Terra Nullius last copy edit went to the publisher, which, as you know, you might know, between a copy edit being finalized and publication date is normally around 3 months. As soon as I sent in my last copy edit, that very next day, I started writing The Old Lie.
Was that the same kind of process you went through writing The Old Lie? Was it just straight out, pantser, in sequence, 3 months?
It was straight out, pants, yeah. It was actually, weirdly, The Old Lie, people say it jumps around in storylines a lot. Well, then my first draft jumped around even more, but they made me... They made me jump around a bit less. But, yeah, it was just pantsed out. But it took longer. It was like 9 months or something. But I was book touring at the time.
Did you find writing the second book a different experience because this wasn't your first time anymore? You're obviously not in a caravan for a few months just writing. You're touring around. Was it a really different experience for you?
It was different, yeah. There was a couple of, mostly it was psychologically different because I knew I could write by then, if that makes sense. I mean, I hadn't had...
Well, yeah. Had you been nominated at that point? No.
Most. I hadn't been, yeah. I'd won the Black and White Prize, which was for, and when it was before it published. But, I'd been published, so I knew I could write a bit. So it was less scary in that way, but also knew that by the time I finished The Old Lie, Terra Nullius had been like nominated for everything. So by the end of the process, I was getting quite scared that I would never write anything as good as Terra Nullius again.
Ah, yes, the weight of expectation.
Now, The Old Lie hasn't been as successful as Terra Nullius at the awards, nowhere even close to as successful at the awards, nor has it so far sold better than Terra Nullius, but it's been reviewed at least as positively or maybe more so. So that just goes to show that expectation is impossible to gauge, and I don't know.
Yeah.
So all I can – but basically the success of Terra Nullius and the different sort of success for The Old Lie in combination have taught me to just write the bloody thing and see what happens.
Did it have an effect on you that The Old Lie didn't get the same kind of instant acclaimed response that Terra Nullius did?
Not really. The thing is, this is really complicated. The Old Lie reviewed better than Terra Nullius, and also it had a way, way, way more buzz because the success of Terra Nullius meant everyone was excited for The Old Lie coming out. But then when the reviews came out, the reviews for The Old Lie in the newspapers and stuff like that were all positive. And they were all within a couple of weeks of it coming out. The reviews for Terra Nullius, they were scattered for over a year.
Oh.
People were waiting to review. People didn't review it because obviously when it first came out, they didn't expect much of it. So they didn't bother to, people didn't bother to review it. So a bunch of the first reviews of Terra Nullius in some media, the first time they reviewed it, were after it was shortlisted for the Stella Prize.
Right, and then all of a sudden the buzz starts to happen.
But the old lie was born with buzz on it, so then people got reviews straight away, and all the reviews are positive. But the thing is, this is one of the conversations that writers have, prizes are weird. You never know which books are going to do well in the prizes. Certainly for Boo to have had as many award mentions as Terra Nullius is certainly unusual. And The Old Lie has not had one.
Yeah.
So, what I would say to people who want to be authors is like, you can't, there's no way to guess how you're going to do in the awards. Absolutely no way at all to guess.
You don't write to the awards either, do you? Just forget about that stuff. You write your book and whatever happens.
I don't even write the publication.
Talk about that. So how was the process of publishing? Because that was a whole new thing for you as well, not only getting the fellowship and writing the book, but then you're going through the process of publication and launching and doing book tours. What was that like? That's a whole world change.
The book tour thing was frankly, you know, extremely bizarre. I'd never stayed in a hotel before my book tour. I hadn't flown in a plane I think I'd flown 3 times in 10 years, and then suddenly I was flying every week. So it was very strange. And I went from being someone who made very little impact on the world around me, except for to my friends, to somebody who is doing media and book touring. So it was all extremely bizarre for me.
Wow, what a head spin.
It was insane. And somebody told me once that Peter Politi. He said the first time you go into a hotel and book tour, you think, do I even belong in this place? And that's how I felt for 2 years.
Imposter syndrome.
Totally. It's the imposter syndrome at book touring is even worse than it is when actually publishing.
Is that because you have to front people? You have to sit there in front of people?
I think that's because you get off a plane, you haven't flown a plane for ages, you get off a plane, you walk down, there's someone holding up your name on a sign. You're picked up in a car, taken to a 4-star hotel generally, put in a hotel room, and then the next day you've got to talk to people, but you get this whole world of this kind of the middle class world and being paid for by other people. It's really strange life. And then you get to a place which is almost seems to be my native habitat, which is Writers Festival Green Rooms. I love Writers Festival Green Rooms. It's like finding that the kind of the gang hangout you've always wanted.
How is your partner going with all of this whirlwind shift in your life and focus and everything in the background of all of this?
She hates it. No, she doesn't hate it as such, but there's before we're traveling around in the caravan a lot, and now we can't travel around in the caravan as much because I'm always off on book tours, etc. So that's a bit annoying, I'm sure. I take her with me when I can. It's made our lives a bit more complicated. That's certainly true.
But she must be very proud of you.
Of course she is, yeah.
Did it blow her away to watch you write this in 3 months, just have it come out of you? And then bam, 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 all this stuff, you know, awards and everything?
I'm not sure if the experience of watching me write it blew her away. Because I've never actually asked that question. And frankly, I find it easiest to write if I start writing before anyone else is up in the morning. She wouldn't have seen most of it anyway. I was getting up at 5 a.m. to write. So she wouldn't have seen much of it, but certainly the experience of me suddenly succeeding at this thing blew her mind.
Because it would have seemingly just come out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Well, you were wanting to write the book, but the speed at which it all occurred.
Yeah.
No, it's not anything anyone could have imagined.
No.
You know, usually people, you know, write the book and they're going off to a publisher for a year or so or an agent and they're getting it assessed and they get rejected and then you write the other book.
It upsets people that I wrote my first book so quickly and then got published immediately. I know people who've spent 10 years on their first novel. Maybe it speaks more to the drive at the time, because I've said to people before, you know, you say to them, could you write 1,000 words a day? And they go, yeah. Well, so, well, that means a standard length Australian novel is 90 days. It's 3 months.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. Sit down, write the words.
Sit down and write the words.
Have something at the end of it. Yeah. But I have to say, what you created in a short period of time has... That's not the average first novel that comes out of a person.
Possibly not.
That is a little bit other level going on there.
Well, the main encouragement I give to other writers is nobody knows how good a writer they're going to be until they write. So therefore they should just write. Because I didn't know what sort of writer I was until I did it.
Claire, it has been such a pleasure to have this conversation with you.
It's been great.
Oh, I have only got through half the list of my points and questions. We might need to do a part two another time. Yeah. Hey, are you writing another book?
I've got a third manuscript being assessed at my publisher.
Ooh.
And I've started on a fourth.
Oh, can you give us any tips or hints about the third one?
No.
Oh, your books are like that. Oh, I look forward to it. And when it comes out, let's revisit and have another chat.
We'll do that. It'll be great talking
Thank
to you.
Thank you, Claire. You too. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Rights for Women podcast. If you've got a minute and you love the podcast, can you please head over to where you're getting your podcast and give us a rating or review? They're super important in the podcasting space, and it's basically the way that other people get to find us and listen to us too. Also, don't forget to head on over to our website, www.rightsforwomen.com, where you'll find our newsletter, our blog posts, every episode we've done, the Rights for Festivals podcast as well. And if you want to, you can sign up to our Patreon page, which basically gives us a few dollars every month to make this podcast. All of our Patreon subscribers get something a little extra. So have a look and see if it's something that you'd be interested in doing. For the people who are already subscribing to our Patreon account, we love you, we appreciate you, and we thank you. It really does make a difference. So thanks. You can also find Rights for Women on Facebook at Rights for Women and on Twitter at W4W Podcast. If you want to keep up to date with all this information, just sign up to the newsletter because we pop it all in there. I think that's all the housekeeping stuff done. Thanks for listening to another episode of Rights Women and joining us for another year. This podcast episode was produced and edited by Kel Butler from Listen Up Podcasting. Podcasts for a positive world.